Hello, and thank you for listening to Talking Asset Management with KBMG. In today's episode, Greg Williams, National Sector Leader for Asset Management at KPMG US, hosts a conversation with KPMG asset management leaders across the Americas, exploring macro trends in the global economy and the impact on the asset management industry.
Hello and welcome to the Asset Management Americans podcast. I'm Greg Williams, U.S. Sector Leader for Asset Management, and I'm joined today by four of my partners, James Lowen, who head of asset management in Canada, Tom Rothfischer, head of the real estate practice in Canada, Carlos Fernandez, our head of asset management in Mexico, and Lino Jr., head of asset management Brazil. So got an all-star panel here to talk about what we're seeing in the asset management space coming up in 2024. Very interesting 2023 year as we continue to get past COVID and the ongoing lingering effects of that and how we unwind from that. So I want to start off, because this time will go quickly, with just taking a view of what's the economic environment in our respective jurisdictions? What do we think about the interest rate environment going into 2024, which is critical to our industry? And so I'm going to start by kicking it to James and Tom, and maybe start with James to say, what's the outlook in Canada? What are you thinking the 2024 will look like from an economic perspective? And more importantly, or just as importantly, what's the interest rate environment looking like?
Thanks, Gregory, and always a pleasure to be here and getting to speak to everyone. It's really, and Tom's going to get the fun part, because quite frankly, our headlines are dominated by real estate stories in Toronto and in Canada every day. And that's everybody's focus is kind of on real estate right now. What's happening with the developers? Are people going to buy and going back into the market and so on? But I would say it's kind of a mixed message here. I'd say from a recovery perspective, we're probably 6 to 9 months behind where the US is at. The good news is we didn't see the recession, or arguably we didn't even see the soft landing that people expected we would. Things held up better than expected. Interest rates are holding steady. We don't think we're going to see further increases, but it's also questionable whether we're going to see much in the way of rate decreases anytime in 2024. Inflation has been still holding pretty strong, and Bank of Canada has been doing everything, you know, every tool in the toolbox to go after it, but it's been pretty pesky, quite frankly. And so I think they're going to hold off on decreases for sure. But at least we're not going to see further increases. That's at least our expectation.
Well, Tommy kind of threw it to you and said you're going to have the fun part in talking about what's the real estate market looking like in Canada as we move into this next year.
Yeah, absolutely. Housing affordability, Greg, has been the topic of the day for many days now. We were fortunate to come out of 2023 a little bit better than some had predicted. But I think as you look forward to 2024, it's a question of which competing forces are going to win out. As James mentioned, we still have a higher cost of capital. We still have a lot of food and housing inflation. But the good news is inflation is starting to come down, and the trajectory of interest rates is, if not stable, looking as potential decreases within 2024. James thought maybe not at all. I'm optimistic that maybe by Q3, Q4, I'm a real estate guy. You got to be optimistic that at some point they'll come down, even though probably not as much as we thought. What's causing the housing crisis here, or the affordability issue, is the population growth. We've had extreme population growth, both through immigration and foreign students. That's actually helped our economy between increased population and government spending. I think that's what kept us out of recession. So that's a counter to some of the negative headwinds. And the labor markets have continued to be strong. So everyone's watching what's going to happen to interest rates, what's going to happen to inflation. Hope that there's not going to be a black swan event that takes us out, but cautiously optimistic, I would say, with emphasis on cautious.
Now it's going to go south from there. You come down to the United States, probably, but James is right. We're probably just a little bit ahead of where Canada is. And our inflation rate has dropped below 3%. The Fed's got a target of 2%. So it's was around 2.6%. So that's working. And so we got a early Christmas present from the Fed that said they feel that they're done raising rates. So at least we got a cap on where they're at. And so the mood of the asset managers in our survey, 68% of them expect to start seeing rate cuts next year. And most economists believe we will see rate cuts. the market had priced in a March rate cut. I think that's not realistic, but more around the May, June timeframe is what most economists are predicting, and anywhere from 3 to 4 cuts at a quarter point each. My personal view, it may be closer to the fall, primarily because the labor markets, we had a strong growth jobs in January, over 350,000 jobs, unemployment rate still at 3.7%. So when you look at that and you say, well, you know, there's really not much stress in the economy that would warrant cutting rates. And there's always that fear, if we cut too soon, does inflation rear its ugly head back again? So I don't anticipate probably a cut till later in the year. And the reality is, when you think about interest rates, for most of my career, you said, well, you got a 4% 10-year treasury rate, you would give 2 thumbs up, say, hey, I'll take that, right? It's just this last time period over the last 10 years we've lived in, which basically near zero interest rates, that, you know, we kind of got used to that and saying, well, is that normal? So the question I think we're going to unwind in the U.S. is, what is normal? What should the interest rate environment be? But I think everyone is pretty optimistic. Like James said, it may not be a soft landing, it may be a no landing. The consumer is still really strong in the U.S., still $1.2 trillion on the consumer balance sheet, consumer sentiment and spending strong. So as we go into 2024, we might talk about the office market here in a little bit. But overall, I think everybody's fairly optimistic that 2024 will be a solid GDP growth year, not anything disproportionate, but maybe 2.5% GDP growth. But it's very interesting, over the last 2 years, we almost seem like we were wishing ourselves into a recession by saying it's coming, it's coming, it's coming, and it just never came. And I think most people are getting comfortable that we've gotten through that and waiting for the next cycle to come. So very, very positive, especially over the last quarter when we were expecting that soft landing to come. Jobs have continued to be strong, which is a good sign for our industry moving to 2024. So Carlos, let's keep going south down to Mexico. How's it look down in Mexico?
It would look very similar to what you just described about the U.S. with not slightly, but way higher rates. Our rate is currently around 1150, and we think it's going to be capped at that level. We don't see rates going down. If any, it would be 250 basis points in the next 2 quarters, but that's it. And we have a similar story when it comes to inflation. Again, high inflation rates, but a decreasing trend. Although inflation has decreased, we don't see rates coming down at the same pace, if you will. And we had a very solid 2023 when it comes to GDP growth. It was way above expectations at the beginning of the year, mainly driven by 3 main things. One, a greater economic activity in the US, which you just described, Greg. Nearshoring, which has had a very powerful impact in our economy. And we don't see nearshoring being done yet. So that's going to translate into having a good outlook for 2024. We don't see GDP growth. We had a 3.5 GDP growth last year. We were expecting 2.5 or so because nearshoring. Otherwise, it would be little bit lower, and also good domestic consumption. Those were the 3 main drivers of our really good 2023 and what sets the stage for 2024. Again, rates not going down, but not going up either. If any, we would expect a 250 basis points in the next 2 quarters, and that would be it, leaving it at 1125 or so. And 2 to 2.5% GDP growth for next year.
Well, it sounds good. Well, Lino, what we've heard now is interest rates not going up anymore, possibly going down, inflation going down in all 3 of our countries. And so GDP growth, good, maybe not great, but good. So let's go on down to Brazil. Similar story in Brazil?
Yeah, Greg. So in Brazil, similar story. 2023, we passed under recession. So interest rate in Brazil today is still high, but today is 11.25%. But the good thing is that inflation is under control, and Brazilian Central Bank has a low target of 9% interest rates by the end of 2024. So as a result of that, the deals market is still low, but we are seeing small signs of recoup. One good thing is that the real GDP growth for Brazil increased 1% from the Q3 and went to 2.6% for the year 2023. So again, we are seeing here the recoup of the market, and we expect a better 2024 than we had in 2023.
Well, much different outlook than what we talked about in our last podcast when interest rates were still going up, inflation was still out of control. So much, much better outlook as we look forward. But with that being said, I know in all of our markets, there are risks and challenges for our asset managers as we look forward to 2024. So why don't we talk about what are some of the risks and challenges that you're seeing for our asset managers as we move into 2024? So I'll just keep the same lineup and start with James. What do you hear your clients talking about for next year?
Well, I mean, Lino hit one right on the head with the deal market. 2023 was the worst year we've had in 40 in terms of deal market, IPO market. So our managers and financial institutions, I mean, they need those markets to come back. I think people are cautiously optimistic if inflation interest rates have stabilized, we're going to start to see price discovery in the latter half of the year. And we are starting to see smaller deals happening, as Lino also mentioned. And managers and financial institutions have a ton of cash. So they've got a lot of dry powder. And so we're quite hopeful. That's the biggest thing. Last year, actually, despite all the challenges, our main stock exchange was up 12%. And it doesn't compare to the US with the Magnificent Seven, obviously. So that's still a pretty reasonable year. And from a product perspective, especially in the retail space, a lot of product was out, a lot of money going into product, especially ETF product, because of interest in high interest savings and an ESG product. And so both of those have come off a little bit. We've already seen in the first now month of the year, that's going to be a challenge. Where is the products that investors are going to be interested in? We have seen a lot of money go into US equity type product, probably not surprising given last year. International equity is coming back, balanced, kind of moving more to the alternative side. Everybody is trying to do something with private credit. Private equity is still pretty soft here. There's some good funds, but they're having trouble getting investors. But private credit, people are so interested. Basically, all institutional, even some of the credit investor groups are looking for a private credit product right now. But managers can't get that out fast enough.
Tom, what about in the real estate market? What are the challenges that you see coming in 2024?
We got to start by saying the mood is still optimistic, right? There are clearly headwinds, and I can talk about some of those, but the overriding view is that that will be short-lived. So the medium-term, longer-term outlook is still positive. What we've got to get over right now and what is creating risk, if you want to put it in that way, is uncertainty. There's pricing uncertainty and there's uncertainty in the market. Take as an example, Greg, your point, interest rates today aren't that much different than maybe what you would have seen as a positive rate in the past. But it's not only the relative change, but it's the volatility in the rate that is creating an issue for taking advantage of opportunity. So look, in the interim, we're clearly seeing signs of distress, especially in the developer market. There have been some high profile liquidation type proceedings, receivership type proceedings. So clearly there is some distress in the system. But overall, everyone's just hunkering down and trying to ride out the storm. And there's plenty of capital, it seems, in the wings that's ready to take advantage of opportunities when they come along. But if you want to look at a few more risks, just at a macro level, clearly, the geopolitical uncertainty, any type of uncertainty that is leading to difficulties in trying to price their deals properly. Climate has become more of an issue here, and that's now being looked at much more closely with some of the losses that have incurred. And as I said before, black swan events, I mean, who knew what they even were a few years ago, but we just seem to have had our share, and so it just made everybody a little bit nervous.
Yeah, I think the U.S. is very similar. I think the deal market, we're waiting for it to return. Agree with James. We're starting to see some green shoots. And the fact that we have a cap on interest rates now, I think is going to lead to some price discovery and going to allow people now to transaction because they have certainty. And I think what I hear in the market, it's really not so much the level of interest rate. It's the volatility, the uncertainty. tell me what the rules are and I will go execute transactions against that. So what is the interest rates going to be? And let me go execute on my strategy. I think the top risk in our survey was availability of capital. And the interesting thing about that is we have record levels of capital as well, levels we've never seen. But the fundraising last year was the worst we've seen in 20 years. And I think the investors are somewhat sitting on the sidelines saying, well, we got a lot of capital out there that's waiting to be invested. So let's get that returned. And the other thing is we still got a lot of price discovery to come. What's happening? What is the market I'm investing into? So I think you've got a little hesitation there. The interesting thing is lack of liquidity or credit wasn't a big risk that they saw, only about 22%. And part of that is even though the banks have tightened their lending standards, the equity funds, the alternative financing have come in and actually filled that gap, obviously at a higher rate, but filled that gap. The other risk I think that our asset manager looking at is margin pressures continue to be real. And so looking at ways that we can do things more efficiently and cut cost as more pressures on fees come to bear. As far as the asset classes, we asked them, which asset class you think provide the best opportunity for return coming in 2024? Private equity was number one at 39%. Credit was second at 38%. So again, I think they're expecting the deal flow to open up the second half of the year, which means there could be some opportunities in private equity. And everybody's trying to raise a credit fund. They think there's going to be an opportunity to fill that credit gap. And then after that, the traditional investments, equity stocks was the next at 23%, real estate at 22% and hedge at 20%. But clearly those two, private equity and private credit, was where they were seeing most of the opportunities. So very similar to what we're seeing in Canada, but I would argue that most people are optimistic that they're going to be able to navigate their way through this. And from a recession perspective, outside of the office market, which we may get to in a minute, be able to come back on the other end and say, hey, this wasn't as bad as we thought it might be when we started into this cycle. So Carlos, what about Mexico? What risk challenges do you see and what you're hearing from the industry?
I think it would be a similar story, starting with a pretty slow deal activity. But in the case of Mexico, it would be impossible not to tie it with political landscape for 2024, which is on one side, you have these high rates, which are attractive for investors. But at the same time, you have the 2024 elections coming and a lot of uncertainty on what's going to happen. And it's a bit complex because whatever happens might not look good for investors. One, if the ruling party prevails, there's a lot of initiatives that just came out yesterday that could compromise bringing certainty to investors, starting with a pension fund reform that just came out yesterday and things like that. If for some reason we were to change parties for president, we don't see the incumbent, if you will, being okay with that. So there would be a lot of tension going on. So from an investor point of view, none of those scenarios make Mexico attractive, at least for 2024. Because of that, despite the high rates and the other good things that we have. So from an asset management perspective, while the economy is set to grow to 2.5%, I don't think the scenario is set for having a great year of a lot of capital coming in and a lot of cash being able to come to Mexico. So it's going to be a interesting year and where a lot of people are cautious on what's going to happen.
Yeah, it sounds like cautious on the uncertainty of the election. So I guess implied in that is that it's still a toss up on how that election will go, that it's pretty tight. So
Right. Yes.
And we'll talk about in a minute, we've got a similar situation in the U.S., but I can understand why capital would sit on the sidelines to wait and see what happens with that election. So,
exactly.
Lino, what about Brazil? What are the challenges you see coming in 24 for Brazil?
In Brazil, if we hear the top managers, so they all say that, you know, market is global. So what happens in the U.S. and China will certainly affect emerging markets like Brazil. Moreover, so Brazil political environment and possible tax reforms will drive the economy in 2024 as well. But one thing that is definitely on the table of them is that persistent inflation, recession risk, and high interest rates in the US are some of the drivers that keep the investors up at night. So also the uncertainty of the 2024 US elections, it's an important driver. And some of them, it's also mentioning the US fiscal deficit, 6% of the GDP, which is a record that they never seen before. And they were afraid about how it's going to be that GDP deficit with the inflation in the US as well. So they really understand that this could drive the economy in Brazil in 2024.
And so you mentioned geopolitical, and you talked about the potential for tax regulation change. Do we think that's high chance that there will be some tax change coming in 2024, or is it just on the table? What's your views on that?
So we have in Congress tax reforms, important tax reforms in Brazil. So this is a subject that is in the lower house for more than 10 years. They now come up with a very good test of the reform. And the expectation is that this tax reform will definitely come up in 2024, which is basically today in Brazil, just for you have an idea, we have more than 20 different taxes for corporations. So they would like to transform those in one or two tax, like IVA, something that we've seen in the international market. So that's what they expect.
And if those tax changes went through, does the asset management industry view that favorably to them?
Favorably. Okay. Favorably. Favorably.
Terrific. Well, maybe we'll stick with geopolitical here since Carlos and Lino, you both touched on it. And I'll come back to the U.S. Obviously, we've got a big election in the U.S. and everybody's mentioned it. The thing about election years for the U.S., especially as it relates to tax policy and changes, you can be certain there will be none of that. So there's just not going to be any significant tax policy changes between now and election. But typically after an election, one of the first bills that's done is a tax bill. So in 2025, we will probably see some type of tax legislation. And actually, what's referred to as a Trump tax cut or the TCJA cuts in 2017, a lot of those expire in 2025 unless Congress takes action. So we expect in 2025, depending on who's successful. Now, the uncertainty about the election, the interesting thing, first time in my lifetime in this country, is we actually know both candidates. And so we actually know kind of what their policies will be. So sometimes the uncertainty is, well, we know what the incumbent looks like, but what will, in this case, we had 4 years of the prior, so we know. So there's a little bit of, depending on who wins, we kind of know kind of how their policy and how they're going to govern. The election itself is a toss-up. That's all I can say. Polls out there are pretty tight. It was very tight last time. It's going to come down to probably three or four states in our electoral college where we vote, and it's going to be very tight. And again, we haven't finalized who the candidates are, but I think it's pretty much a foregone conclusion. It's going to be former President Trump and current President Biden that we will be choosing from. But then even more important than that is from a policy perspective and a legislative perspective, Congress is the one who passes tax laws. Presidents don't. Presidents can veto. That has to be overridden by a large majority of Congress. So the bigger question for me from a policy perspective is who's going to be in charge of Congress? And today we have a split Congress where the Democratic Party controls the Senate and the Republican Party controls the House, by very, very thin margins. If that continues, that split, it also gives us certainty that there won't be much done even post-election. Because in order to get something done, you have to have both sides of Congress be able to support it. And when you have a split Congress, there's not much of significance that gets done. There's such division. And so if that happens, I wouldn't expect significant changes, but just things around the margins. If, though, one party or the other controls both houses, which it's possible because it's so close, then we might be able to see some significance in changes in legislation. But right now, with the divisiveness we have between the two parties, there's not a lot of appetite broadly to work together to try to solve significant problems. So from an investor perspective, though, understanding what each of the two candidates will be like in their role, we kind of know. And so once the election's complete, I think we'll be able to start executing on our strategy with being certainty of what's going to happen. So a lot of people in this country would love for the Congress to continue to be divided. That kind of puts a governor on what they may or may not do. But then I think who's in the White House also is going to have more of an impact on what foreign policy looks like. Been much different this time. And so the broader global geopolitical environment does sit as a concern for some of our asset managers that are investing globally. It's a small world. What is that going to look like? So that's kind of the geopolitical. And I think we have concerns about what's happening in the Middle East, what's still happening with Ukraine, Russia, what's happening China, Taiwan, just around the world. There's still a lot of unrest. And as Tom said, a black swan event, because something that could bring the world into some type of conflict or something that was not anticipated. I think that's still on the minds of people because we have had, as Tom said, a number of these black swan events over the last few years that no one saw coming, not just COVID. I mean, just a lot of other things, whether it's the banking crisis we had in the U.S. with the run on the banks, or just things that you never anticipate. From a geopolitical side in Canada, I mean, I know we talked about Mexico and Brazil, a little bit about the U.S. Is there anything on the minds in Canada? Y'all have big elections that could have consequences coming up in Canada?
We're obviously watching what's going to happen in the U.S. as well. It's very, very important to us. I think it is more, it's not as much a kind of a business focus as it is around, does it destabilize? Does it affect things geopolitically? So I think that's kind of the Canadian perspective. We do have a federal election coming next year. The expectation is we're going to have a change. And quite frankly, the expectation with that is that'll be good for business, good for asset managers, good for the economy. We'll see how it plays out. But right now, the ruling party is looking a little bit like a lame duck. So we're going to have to see kind of, obviously, lots can change between now and next year. Everything else is, I mean, it's very divisive here too, but it's fairly stable at the provincial and at the municipal levels.
Well, what about a talent perspective? Because in our industry, the war for talent continues to be a challenge, continues to be whether it's attract, retain, because without talent, you're not going to win in the market. And so maybe we kind of go down and Tom, I don't know if you want to start with in Canada, what's the talent situation, labor market look like for our clients?
Yeah, it's interesting, Greg. We probably should have mentioned that under your comment of what the risks are that our clients are facing. I don't care who I talk to, they all have this issue. And interestingly, it's not just in the real estate space, it's in every corner of the economy. Getting the type of skilled labor that you need is definitely on the minds of everyone and is a huge challenge for organizations. I mean, it's a huge challenge for us as an organization as well. That's part of what is motivating just the sheer volume of immigration that we're getting into this country. And that has helped us quite a bit. I think without that level of immigration, we would have had very severe challenges with our economy. And so we've got to balance that a little bit because, as we mentioned before, there's nowhere for these folks to actually live. Going to your question of the constraints on labor, it's very much an issue here in Canada.
There's actually an article in our national newspaper today about the fact that taxpayers might not be able to find accountants as we come up to the tax deadlines, just because epidemic of the issues that we've already talked about. But I tend to think of it more of a back of the house than a front of the house issue. That's really where we're seeing the talent issue. But I don't think it's a problem of not having enough CFAs in the market. And quite frankly, right now, our investment banks have been letting people go because there's been no M&A, but people supporting and back office functions are really, really challenged right now for all our financial institutions and quite frankly, for all service providers.
Yeah, and the U.S. continues to be the same. I mean, you hear headlines of some of the technology companies having layoffs, but the bottom line is we got 3.7% unemployment. There's 1.2 job openings for every person looking for a job and continues though, even top talent continues to have opportunity to be swept away from competitors. So it continues to be a risk and a concern for our asset managers about not just how to attract, but how do I retain them? How do I think about their mental well-being, you know, their work-life balance? How do I create loyalty with that employee so they're not taking all the skills that they learned at our organization, just taking them somewhere else? So you're seeing people get very creative in benefits and things to retain people, but it continues to be a challenge, especially in certain markets and in certain areas. So very, very similar. So Carlos, what about the labor market in Mexico? Is it tight or is it starting to get back to equilibrium?
It would be no different from what you just described. We're seeing, even though companies are doing all they can to provide work-life balance, to make a very attractive place to work, none of that has helped them in retaining people. There's a mentality of jumping from one job to another, regardless of what the offer at that job is. So those efforts have not had the effect on retention that companies would have wanted. And also, just like James said, it's more of a support areas where we are seeing the issue, a lot of people not being attracted to those areas anymore. So we're struggling in the asset management market, and we as a firm as well. It's the same. It has to do with expectations of people on the offers that you can have for those people. But yeah, it's something we're struggling with a lot here in Mexico.
Yeah, certainly. If your retention strategy is the same as it was 20 years ago, you're not doing very well. The generation that's in the workforce today, what they want out of their career, out of the employer they work with, their expectations, it clearly has changed. So if you're not changing with that, then you're not going to be successful in retaining the talent that you want. So, Lino, same thing in Brazil. There's still a shortage of talent, or are we starting to get back to more of an equilibrium?
Same thing here. We are tired of talent. So, and one interesting thing that we are debating here is the conflict of generations. So we have the past generations that understand that should be in the office all day. So we have the new generation, majority the ones that live the COVID time, the pandemic time. They understand that they don't need to be all day in the office anymore. So we have this conflict of generations, and not only internally, but also our clients are suffering with this. And what we are seeing, no matter benefits you give to them, they still continue to have this conflict. So they would like to have a different way of work. And I think we all need to adapt to that, to the way that will be good for both generations. So that's what we are thinking here.
So let's stick with the return to office, and I'll stick with you because it seems to be an issue. It clearly is an issue in the U.S. So, you know, in the U.S. today, most of the industry has went hybrid, right? Went some 3 days a week. But our survey, our global CEO survey that I know you all guys looked at last year, we asked the question of CEOs, the jobs that were in office pre-COVID, what percent do you think will be in office in the next 12 months? And last year, 32% said they'd be back full time in the year. This year it was 62. And so you're starting to see at least the thought of the CEO saying that we're going to have more back in the office. I think in the U.S., you're starting to see a movement from remote to hybrid to some back full time. And I think we're going to continue to see that pendulum move. I don't believe we're going to get back to pre-COVID levels, but I think it'll be closer to that than it is today. But you're right, it continues to be a challenge, even making those baby steps of all remote to hybrid. So let maybe just go around home where your country's in that. Are you the same thing? I think I would probably say that 60 to 65% of our workers in the U.S. are hybrid now, and maybe 20 to 25% are in office, and then less than 5% fully remote. But where in Brazil, maybe start there, are you seeing the same thing? Majority of people are hybrid?
Yes. So today, our policy is 3 days in the office, 2 days at home office. So we are hybrid, but we are in the moment of changing the policy, you know, to continue to be 3-2, but with more present in clients. So we are seeing the lack of presence in clients like we had before. And for some clients, the ones that allow us to do so, If they are working 5 days, so we're going to come back with the team at the client site 5 days per week. It will really depend on client to client basis. But for our company, so we will continue to be hybrid with more presence with not only the staff and the team, but the partners as well in the client site.
From the broader asset management industry in Brazil, though, are they hybrid as well, or a lot of more of them moving back to full-time in office?
Yeah, the administrators, they are still hybrid, but the managers, they come back full.
Okay.
We have like some clients hybrid and some clients full, and that's the reason why we started to adopt client-to-client basis. So those clients that are working 5 days, so we will try to work 5 days as well.
Yeah, and I think some of our in the market that have went back full-time in office, it's a different full-time than what maybe historically you've been. When I remember starting in this business, I was afraid to stay home and wait on the repairman because I got to be in the office or I'm going to lose my job. I think what COVID did, it really made it clear that you could be productive from home. You could still work. And so if you've got a sick child, if you've got, you know, to wait on a repairman, even though you may be required to be in the office, you can still be effective and be home. So I think it's going to be an evolution as we go forward. What about Mexico, Carlos? Is the industry back in the office? They hybrid, they remote? What are you seeing?
If you ask the industry what they want, they will be fully in person all the time. There's no way people are willing to fully in-person work. They'd rather do fully remote. Hybrid would be like the in-between, but no further than that. So that's made a lot of companies struggle. Retaining people, a lot of the jobs require in-person interaction to do it better. We all know that, but there's been a lot of resistance in Mexico to go back to work fully in-person. I think, unlike many other geographies, distance and commutes come into play. And so during pandemic, they tasted what not commuting for 3 hours on the way to work and on the way back home was like. So they want to skip that part. They started to have a work-life balance because they could do other stuff or work even more like a lot of us did. But the size of this city has to do with also that resistance I'm talking about. So they're still trying to balance what the best mix is, but I don't see any of our clients going to fully in-person in the short term because of what I just said.
Yeah,
I think Carlos just hit the nail on the head. In Canada, it is completely city dependent. Toronto is really struggling to get people right back because we have terrible traffic and terrible commutes. And so all of our clients want everybody back. And quite frankly, all the service providers do too. Everybody is hybrid. Right. And it's a real, real challenge. Whereas Montreal, Calgary, not the same. Not the same. They're getting people back and getting people back downtown. So I really think commute and traffic has become a big, big factor in what right people decide to do.
Here in Brazil, we are seeing also the same resistance that Carlo mentioned for some of our people say, if you change completely the hybrid system, I'm out. So,
yeah, we've had some of the same in the U.S. with some of our clients. Some of those have called the bluff of the employees and haven't seen the exit, but there's always that risk. And we have the same thing in the U.S. The return to office, if you look at the statistics of office occupancy by city, you can see it's higher in the cities that have the shorter commutes. And so it's no different here. We just got a couple of minutes. I wanted to touch on, because it's on every boardroom I'm in, every client I'm at, everybody wants to know what's people doing around Gen AI. It's the hottest topic. And granted, I think Gen AI, when it first started talking about it 10 months or a year ago, now it encompasses, seems like everything, right? Whether it's cloud, whether it's technology, it's all Gen AI. But just from what you're seeing, what are your clients thinking about Gen AI as we move forward in 2024? Maybe start with Canada. What are Tom, you or James hearing from the market around Gen AI?
Everybody's experimenting with it, no question about it. And although it's still very much early days, it's amazing how it's already having a major impact on administrative tasks. just taking a simple example, something like translation, right? Because, of course, that's a big issue for our managers who offer products in Quebec. Gen AI is changing that business literally overnight. And that industry hasn't gone away yet, but it's not going to be the same industry in a year. And so we're seeing that with people like looking at how they deal with prospectuses. And in every aspect of our managers' day-to-day, they're looking at how it can impact. I mean, we hear about some that it's impacting trading, but I think it's really more in the administration and the back office right now. But it's definitely having an impact, no question. I don't know, Tom, if you're seeing the same thing in real estate.
Yeah, look, in real estate, this is a progression of the conversations we've been having with our clients on data and analytics. They recognize not only that technology and the increased implementation of technology is going to be required to get a competitive advantage, but you know, this concept of data being the new oil is important to them. As it translates into AI and generative AI, to your point, everyone's dabbling. You know, we see in the brokerage community, we see, you know, our clients have implemented AI to assist in the leasing processes and helping their clients deal with that. We do have clients that are investigating how to use Gen AI to optimize business processes. And clearly, when it comes to contracts and reading of contracts, the implementation of AI has really enhanced what the optical character recognition systems really could do. So, you know, I would say they're experimenting. It's probably not front office bound yet, but the use cases are expected to grow quickly, and I look forward to what they're able to do.
Now, the U.S. would be very similar, so I wouldn't have anything to add to that, but really more about, think back office, performance of daily task. You're continuing trying to find use cases to help become more efficient. So any different in Brazil or Mexico or similar, just experimenting to see how we could utilize this new technology?
I would say we're one step behind, and we know we should start experimenting and all the benefits, but we're not there yet. We're conscious of all the benefits that Gen AI can bring to the table, but we're not there yet. That would be the difference with Mexico, I think. There's a lot of things going on. Where do we start? That would be my take for Mexico.
In Brazil, no doubt about managers that Gen AI will help the industry. So some of them looking, so how immediately they can help on the back office and middle office operations. But also, I think when you look like advanced analytics for portfolio optimization or asset allocation, algorithm trading. So this is something that they have as a dream, but will definitely help in the future.
Terrific. Well, this hour's went a lot quicker than I anticipated. So let me first thank my colleagues and friends for joining us. And thank you for taking the time for listening to this podcast. Feel free to reach out to any of us with any follow-up or questions you may have. We'd love to connect with you personally and individually. And with that, we'll sign off and we'll talk to you next time. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Talking Asset Management with KPMG. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast and visit read.kpmg.us/talking-asset-management for more information.